You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, presented by Veteran Strategies, sponsored by the Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, and Aaron Shaler, our new friend, a mortgage broker with Grandview Lending. Our guest today is thrice elected.
Yes.
Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry. Deep background here in the city and the state, and we're very pleased to have you. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Yeah, I'm hoping this is fun.
Well, if it's not, I guess you could just throw me in jail, right?
Yeah. Guess I could.
You are born and bred here? Tell us a little bit about your background.
My parents are both originally from Ellettsville, and my dad went into the Navy in World War II, sort of a typical story of parents of someone my age, and then went to IU and was a lifelong educator. And so as he moved up from assistant basketball coach and teacher to head basketball coach and teacher to principal, to school superintendent, we moved around a fair amount. And when I was a kid, we went from Ellettsville to Liberty to back to Ellettsville to Bedford to Mooresville to Shelby County and then back to Mooresville. And my dad was superintendent at Mooresville for 20 years. And then I went to Butler undergrad.
Was he superintendent or involved in Mooresville when Sammy Davis was there, the Medal of Honor recipient?
He would have been there when Sammy Davis graduated from high school. Well, no, I'm sorry. He would have come back to Mooresville not long after Sammy Davis graduated from high school.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get Sergeant Davis on the podcast. It would be amazing. He's incredibly engaging, great story, wonderful sense of humor. And if you read his Medal of Honor citation, you simply cannot believe he survived.
Right. And, you know, I'm sure you already know those sequences in Forrest Gump are actually from what he did in Vietnam, as well as the medal presentation at the White House.
I had heard a story at the time that, you know, when you receive the Medal of Honor, it usually replaces, it's an upgrade, right? Like a lot of times you get awarded an Army, a Distinguished Service Cross, and then you get the Medal of Honor and then you don't keep your cross. But I'd read, and I'll have to ask him if I can get him on, that his exploits were so amazing that he was awarded a Silver Star, then he eventually received the Medal of Honor, that they allowed him to keep his Silver Star because what he did was so incredible. But he's very, very humble about it, you know, does a lot of work for veterans, and his wife's a sweetheart too. So I guess I need to make that call, see if he can come on. I'm not sure how often he comes back, but I bet he's back during May for the race. Went to Butler University. Was it Butler University because of a particular subject area, or it's just where you wanted to go?
This is beyond embarrassing to admit, but I was looking to go somewhere where I could play both golf and basketball. I was good enough in golf to play at a larger school, but not big enough or good enough to play basketball. And so I looked primarily at Evansville and Butler, and ultimately settled on Butler because I did not want to get too far away from my high school study. And after about 30 days at Butler and being around co-eds, my steady was history. But even though I made the decision for really stupid reasons, I don't regret a thing. Butler, my experience at Butler was great. It's a great education, great school, and everything's worked out very well.
Were you recruited to play basketball? Did Toby Hinkle recruit you? Was he still around then?
Not specifically recruited, and you know, you're going to think I'm making this up. But my high school basketball coach was actually a former Butler player. His name was Larry Ramey, and he had played at Butler. And so that was part of the Butler connection. I had qualified at that point, been accepted and qualified for an academic scholarship that was going to pay half of my tuition. And I literally went up and met with Tony Hinkle, who then had been given information about what I had done in high school, what I played. And he then offered me a scholarship with the other half of my tuition and books, and told me literally that I could play basketball, golf, or baseball, whatever I wanted.
Really?
Truly.
So let's fast forward before we go talk about your law school career or whatever. What was the feeling when Butler made the title game 2 years in a row?
Oh, just, you know, to this day, just seems surreal to think about that, you know, a school of that size, even with the tradition they have. You know, the first year, obviously, you know, they had a great combination of players and had a great season. But then to turn around and repeat that the next year was just, yeah, it was a lot of fun, obviously, for Butler grads.
Over the losses yet?
Obviously the worst is you know, Hayward's shot, you know, rimming out there, to which would have beaten Duke. That's painful.
We had Tom Coverdale on the podcast a few weeks ago, right at the end of March Madness, and I asked him about, I think it was 2002 when IU made it to the final game and lost to Maryland. Is he over it? And he just was like, no. Yeah. He made no bones about it. Like, it's something you'll never forget, and it'll be with you for a long time. I completely get it. Were you able to attend both games?
No. Actually, the one that was here, I'd been offered tickets, but I'd heard from so many people that the sight lines were horrible, and you know, unless you're right down close. And so I literally decided, no, I just want to be able to stay at home and watch the game, which I did. You know, having gone then a few years ago when we had the Final Four here, let's see, that was when Duke won. Duke beat Wisconsin in the final, and so I had tickets there, and I've told people, I think my seats were in northern Johnson County.
Yeah, so, basketball games at Lucas Oil Stadium would, I mean, it's, yeah, what the tickets, yeah, it's what the economics demand, but yeah, yeah. I couldn't imagine it.
So I did actually play my freshman year at Butler. You know, I'm so old that I don't know if you would recall, but for a period of time, freshmen could not play in Division I schools, right, could not play in major sports. And so schools still had separate freshman teams for basketball, football, and baseball. And so I played both golf and basketball my freshman year. And then after that, just played golf all 4 years.
I think it's the famous story that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, at the time Lou Alcindor, went to UCLA, couldn't play his freshman year, played the next 3 years. His overall record in college was 88-2. His freshman team repeatedly beat the varsity team at UCLA, which was a four-time defending national championship team. That's how good.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And at the same time frame, George McGinnis and Steve Downing, as a freshman team at IU, beat the varsity in the preseason scrimmage also.
Yeah, so it tells you how much college sports has changed, yeah, from you can play 1 year and leave, or to your freshman year, you couldn't play. What made you decide to go to law school? You went to IU Law School, as I recall. Is that right? And is that something that you wanted to do, be an attorney?
Yeah, I had, at the time I was an undergrad at Butler, you know, there's still a lot of schools, and particularly at Butler, referred to some majors as pre-law major, you know, and in reality it was political science and history. Yes, I anticipated when I went to Butler that's what I wanted to do. My senior year, however, I started working at the Indianapolis News. I was married, had gotten married, and worked at the old Indianapolis News, then went into the Army for 2 years and came back and worked for two more years at Indianapolis News, and was not sure then whether I kind of liked journalism, and I wasn't sure. And then finally decided, you know, that, yeah, I going to law school is what I wanted to do. And unfortunately, at that point, I was married, had a child. I'm not sure I could have afforded it, but for the GI Bill. And then I was able to attend law school on the GI Bill.
I was going to ask you that. What made you decide to join the military? You must have joined in the early 70s, so that's before the draft was ended.
Right.
Did you have a high number?
I had a very low number, which meant that I was going to get drafted that year. So my fourth year at Butler was 71, and so I knew that I was going to be drafted before the end of the year, going back to my scholarships. My scholarships were exhausted at that point. I still needed like 6 hours to graduate after the 4 years there. And so I went ahead and did a 2-year enlistment just to get started on it, because it was inevitable that was going to happen in 1971. So I did a 2-year enlistment.
Do you remember your draft number?
89.
Everybody remembers it. It was such a, you can't conceive now in 2019 what a huge deal the draft was in the late 60s and early 70s, for obvious reasons, for Vietnam, and that your number was how you was going to dictate the next few years of your life.
Yeah. You know, and everyone has similar stories, people of my age who went through that. But, in my situation, one of my best friends, had a similar number, and he was drafted before the year end. But on the other hand, two of my best friends had wrecked their knees playing freshman football, and they had real high numbers, so they were never going to get drafted. But they wouldn't have been eligible in any event.
What did you find enticing about working in the media? And what exactly did you do for the news?
I did just some general reporting, but for the most part, I covered federal government, and which was primarily federal courts. And so I covered the federal courts. Also did there was not a specific person who did concert reviews or album reviews, that sort of thing. And so all of our younger staff members sort of passed that around. So I did some of that. And I just enjoyed it. I have decent writing skills, and I think one skill that I have that's served me well, but first as a reporter and now as a trial attorney, is I can be a pretty quick learn, and being a trial attorney, in any given subject, you have to be able to learn enough to be conversant on it, at least for those that week of trial. Being a reporter, it was very similar, that on any given subject, you would need to research enough to be able to intelligently discuss it and obviously describe it for purpose of an article. So I did enjoy it, but then a couple of friends of mine who had laid out a couple of years after undergrad had started law school, and I started thinking about it again, and I can't imagine now that I would have done anything else than do that.
We had Bill Benner on the podcast a while ago. Do you remember him there?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And they were on the Star side, of course. Right. The Indianapolis News, the Star and News were both owned by the Pulliam family, and the News was the afternoon paper. So there was really not any overlap between the staffs as such, but yeah, obviously you knew who the Star reporters were.
Do you remember any of the concerts you reviewed? Freaking Strawberry Alarm Clock and Matt the Hoople and
I did a review of he's a movie star. Drawing a blank. He had a horror. He also played country music. I can picture him. Me and Bobby McGee, he wrote that song.
Chris Christopherson.
Yeah. He played at like the Ritz or one of those places out on the east side. Only played for about 30 minutes, was clearly drunk or high, surly, worst concert. So that was one. I did a review of Bob Dylan and the band when they did the...
Robbie Robertson, the band?
Yeah, when they did their final tour. They played at Assembly Hall in IU. I did a review of John Hyatt's very first album, John Hyatt's from Indy, and His mom worked with one of my fraternity brother's sisters and learned that that I did the reviews. And literally, I came into the newsroom one day and they said, this woman wants to see. And it was John Hyatt's mother who brought me the album and asked if I could review it. I did. I have that album to this day. I still have it.
Did you hang around
the observatory. That was the name of the album.
Well, we had Mark Allen on the on the podcast to talk about a lot of the things he reviewed. And actually, Lundquist from The Star is going to come on. Excuse me, David Lundquist from The Star is going to come on and talk about a lot of the things that he did. That seems to be a pretty darn good way to make a living. Go to concerts and for free and have great seats. And all you got to do is just say, okay, here's what I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Of course, now you know you seldom see that stuff in the hard copy. It's just online, but I still read them for sure.
So you go from being a newspaper reporter, you decide to become a lawyer. Are there any other occupations that poll at 8% popularity that you'd like to share with us that you decided to take your hand at? IRS agent? Anything else? You seem to be kind of like someone who doesn't shy away from doing the tough job.
Well, even once I started practicing law, once I graduated from law school, I think that some thought I couldn't hold a job. I like to think of it as new challenges. But you know, once I graduated, I initially worked at a firm, a small. Litigation boutique firm, Summer Bard, here in town, worked there for about 4 years. Literally, I had lunch one day with John Tinder, who at that time was chief deputy in Steve Goldsmith's office, after we chit-chatted, had lunch, he called me the next day and said, hey, would you have any interest in coming over here and doing white-collar crime? I was like, yeah, that sounds like fun. So I went over there for 3 years under Steve Goldsmith, went back to the same firm as a partner. Worked there about 5 more years, hated it, and missed being at the prosecutor's office. And so I went back to the prosecutor's at the very start of Jeff Modisett's term and worked there 3 more years. Then I hung out a shingle for a period of time and had solo practice.
What drew you to being a prosecutor? And I noticed that you've got a terrific reputation in the political world as someone who plays it straight. You worked for Goldsmith. You worked for Modisett. So let's just throw politics out for a second, and we'll get to your run in 2010 when you won the first time. But is being in the prosecutor's office seen as the white hat, like you're the good guys and the other folks are quote unquote the bad guys? Is it that sort of thing, or what draws you to the office, to working with that team, doing that job, putting people in jail?
I wouldn't view the description as that stark, in terms of white hats. I mean, clearly, our responsibility is to prosecute any crime that touches upon Marion County, but that doesn't mean that. We resolve 30,000 criminal cases a year. That doesn't mean we're looking to put 30,000 people in prison. In any particular situation, the circumstances might dictate that, we need to find a way to get that person out of the criminal justice system. I guess as a general proposition, how I describe why I love doing it and why I think everyone in our office enjoys doing it is just the gratification of getting a result for people who have been victimized by a crime. Now, in some circumstances, that means someone needs to go to prison, and they need to go to prison not only as getting justice for the victimized person, but people who have demonstrated they shouldn't be living among us. But at the very other end of the spectrum, for me personally, we get significant gratification out of finding alternative ways to get individuals out of the criminal justice system and hopefully on a path where they're going to become productive members of our community.
Well, 50 years ago, the white hat was Perry Mason. And it seems in the last 10 to 20 years, the white hat is Jack McCoy from Law and Order.
You had to describe who that was. I wouldn't have known who that was. I do not watch law shows, TV shows, movies.
But you don't like shows that depict courtrooms and or movies that depict quite courtroom dramas?
Oh, it's not that I dislike them. It's just, you know, those of us who do it know how unrealistic it is. And
something like Law and Order where the prosecutors actually lose. I remember Judge Altice, who's now Justice Altice. Justice, right. Justice Altice.
No, he is
Court
judge.
Of Appeals, he's
Court of
judge.
Appeals judge.
He's
only
judge.
Supreme Court
is justice. Justice. Thank you. Yeah. I talked to him about it one time when I was in one of my Law and Order phases, which I've, of course, bequeathed to my kids. And he said, I like this show. He goes, the show doesn't always get it right. He goes, but it's nice to know that they actually lose because Perry Mason famously won every case. But it did seem to shift the focus towards the prosecutor's side of things and how hard these guys work for very little to no money. And that would seem to be ubiquitous when it comes to prosecutors. No, they're not going to make that much money, and they do it anyway. Partly for training, maybe for later, but perhaps sure. Out of just pure altruism.
Sure. No, people ask me all the time, and if you're going to ask me this question, I'm preempting your question, but people literally ask me all the time what I like best about my job. My answer is the same every time. As I say, I get to come into an office every single day where of about 400 employees, where virtually every single person there loves what they do. They get a lot of satisfaction on what they do. We all have each other's back, and it's just a great atmosphere to come in and work every day.
You probably worked with Carol Johnson.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when I was a deputy prosecutor, I did.
Yeah, so Carol Johnson, who passed away several years ago, was the mother of my best friend in grade school named Chris Johnson.
Is that right?
Yeah, I saw her all. I remember when she was in law school.
Yeah, Carol.
IQ of about 290.
Yeah, Carol, you said something about training. You know, one of the things we know going in is that most people, particularly the attorneys, are not going to end up staying there for their entire life. I mean, they're, you know, you already said it. We're not paid well. So we know that most people will move on, but there are on occasion individuals who make it a career for their entire career. And Carol was one. She was a career prosecutor.
Yeah. A wonderful, wonderful mother, a great person. You're listening to Leaders and Legends, presented by Veteran Strategies and sponsored by the Girl Scouts of Central Indiana and our good friend Aaron Shaler, who's a mortgage broker with Grandview Lending. You worked in the prosecutor's office. You did other things. You hung out your shingle. And then sometime in 2010, you decided, what the heck? I'll throw my hat in the ring, as Teddy Roosevelt famously said. What made you decide to actually run for public office and that office?
Yeah. And actually, I had been a candidate for prosecutor once before, back in 2001, 2002, Well, I didn't run the primary. I went to slating, and I was not slated, and never thought I would do it again. In 2009, I was literally exchanging emails with someone about golf, and in one of his replies, he said, "Hey, there's a group of us want you on for prosecutor." And so several people talked to me about it. Obviously, I'm a Democrat, and the people in the party. And I still wasn't sure I wanted to do it at that point in my life. My wife at the time, now my ex-wife, she was still pretty bitter over what had happened in 2002. And I said to several people, I said, I don't know if I want to do it, but I said, Sheila's really not going to be.
But it was almost a blessing in disguise, right? Yeah. Because I think Jim Osborne, who's a good man, ran against Carl Brizzi, and Carl Brizzi won handily. 2002 was a good Republican year after 9/11. I think they swept the county, except for Frank Anderson, another good man. And so maybe that was a blessing.
Yeah. Well, and then, so I told my wife, I said, people are asking me to run. And I thought she would just say, and she just said, she didn't hesitate. She goes, no, you need to do it. She goes, you're the happiest you've ever been in the time I knew you when you were at the prosecutor. You need to do it. And so obviously I made the decision to do it. Did the usual things that you do when you're touching base with various individuals in the party and around the county. And now I can't imagine I wouldn't have done it.
Golf prowess help you raise money, help you win friends and influence people?
Well, we have, on the one hand, we have had a golf outing each year as one of our fundraisers, and you know, we've not raised a ton of money doing that. But on the other hand, the being Marion County prosecutor and the 24/7 nature has not been good for my golf game. I will say that.
I think Mayor Ballard at one time was like a 7 mm-hmm. handicap or 8, but mm-hmm. he goes, then when you're mayor, everybody wants to play political golf. Like, that's different than regular golf.
Yeah, no, one of the, after I was prosecutor, one day I'd set up a game, and it was the bipartisan foursome. I had Mayor Ballard, Ryan Vaughn, and Vernon Brown.
Ryan, who has been on the podcast, he and Vernon are close. Yeah. They're good friends.
Yeah.
So who would you choose if you had to put together your foursome of, besides the one you just mentioned, of the best golfers you've played with, politicos, who would you choose?
Oh, that's tough. Mayor Ballard had a good swing. The greens drove him crazy. They were really fast.
So Jason Dudich, who was the former city controller, state budget director, who's now moved to UND, he was like a 6 or 7 handicap. He was really, he played at IU or played a lot.
I honestly cannot think of many other public officials who are worth a darn. In fact, some are just horrible. Which I guess is a good thing. You know, we might have a question about their commitment to their job.
I remember when I started my own business in 2010, one of the people I took to lunch to ask their opinion, ask his opinion, and soon to be whose podcast you will have heard before you hear this one, is Ed Tracy, former mm-hmm. chairman of the Marion County Democratic Party a couple of times. And I asked him, you know, I'm a veteran. I can start a veteran business. You know, I think there's some advantages. What are your thoughts? All it did was cost me lunch at the Golden Ace. And I told him, I said, you know, one of the things I worry about is I don't drink alcohol and I don't play golf. And I worry about that, losing that networking edge. Mm-hmm. And Ed's reply was very interesting. He goes, Robert, golf is a waste of time. I go, but you don't get business through golf? He goes, no, you work while others play golf. He goes, that's not a hindrance. It's actually a help. Completely opposite of what I thought he was going to say. Uh-huh. 'Cause you know, he's political and has done the rounds all those years, no pun intended. And, it does seem to be a uniting game. You mm-hmm. mentioned the bipartisanness. How does someone navigate the political waters these days, especially in an office where there's so much scrutiny and so much opportunity for people to point their finger and say, that Curry, he's just playing politics?
Mm-hmm. My answer would not be applicable to, say, our first run. But I actually heard Bart Peterson say this at one time, which is ironic because obviously he ultimately lost an election, but he said, you know, the best reelection strategy is to govern well. And so, you know, for me, I've always felt that if we just do our job, now obviously it has to be get communicated to the public in some manner that we're doing our job. But if we just do our job and focus on our job, then the political stuff, the election, will take care of itself. And you know, I feel like that's what we've done. And obviously, the demographics of the county is a benefit. But on the other hand, I do feel that we just get positive feedback all the time from the public. And the other part of it is, you know, our office is out in the community. You know, I'm out in the community constantly. Our community prosecution division's out. And so there's a face of the office that's out in the community all of the time. And, you know, I get feedback about, you know, that Drew Wignall out in Northwest has been great helping us address, you know, problem such and such in our neighborhood. You know, and so all of that stuff is, number one, stuff we should be doing if we're going to do our job. But the secondary aspect of that, or residual benefit of that, is that if for re-election, you know, we've done our job and people perceive we've done our job.
Is it, I would say, along with the sheriff and the mayor, the highest profile jobs in Marion County, but you also have to work with the state. You also have to work with the feds. Is it hard to maintain a balance and not, and this isn't about personalities per se, because there's good people in all these offices or hold these positions, but in a sense, does it stuff become territorial, or is it more like, you know, Terry, I'm happy if you handle that, or we're happy to throw this to the feds, that sort of thing, because they're high profile and kind of high risk, high reward positions.
I obviously only have the perspective of being involved in this job here, but I can tell you for a fact that I've had so many different federal investigative agency personnel, you know, including even the agents in charge of, say, DEA, FBI, who have served all over the country, say to me, and I know they're being genuine because I've heard it from so many, that they have never worked anywhere where everyone works together so well. We are in constant communication among all of those agencies, you know, starting with the fact that our office actually serves 30-some police agencies just here in Marion County.
Yeah, because there's most, drug task force.
Most people don't realize it. Yeah. Well, I'm talking about Southport, Beach Grove. Every college has a police department. And then,
IPS.
And then with the federal agencies, I mean, we are truly, it's not just a cliche, we're truly all on the same page. And so it's a great way to approach.
And do your ties here help? I mean, I'm gonna make a guess here. Correct if I'm wrong, but I would imagine you've known Marion County Sheriff and future podcast guest Kerry Forstall for decades. I mean, you had to have known him for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, in many ways,
and Mayor Hogsett, you've probably known him for a while. Yeah. I mean, all that has to help.
I say all the time, I've known Joe since he used to be fun.
Mayor, we'd love to have you on. That wasn't me.
No, I've told him that. I'm not sure he disagrees with me.
Well, he's got a big job. The mayor of a million people is a big job.
He has a big job.
Is it the mayors are kind of, there's a club. There's one of the best books I've ever read and would recommend to anyone who likes history and likes American or modern American presidential history. It's a book called The President's Club. And I think it's Nancy Gibbs maybe and Michael Duffy, but it's a book about how ex-presidents got along with their successors. Terrific stories. 99%, 90% of the time they get along great. The frostiest relationship actually was between Truman and Eisenhower, which lasted really and kind of until Kennedy's funeral in 63 and they reconciled. But anyway, mayors kind of famously have a club, you know, Greg Ballard and Bart Peterson and Luger and Hogsett. Do prosecutors do the same thing? Do you ever ring up Scott Newman or Steve Goldsmith and just kind of say, hey, or have lunch with Modisette? Does that kind of exist at all?
No, not really. Scott, who I admire a lot, obviously he's had health issues since he served as prosecutor. Steve Goldsmith, actually out of the blue, it's probably been 3 years ago now. His assistant contacted me and said he was going to be in town and just wanted to come by and say hello. And he came and we just chit-chatted on a Friday morning for about 2 hours.
Is that weird? Your former boss and now you're sitting in his seat?
Not really. Not really. Modisette moved to California, so he's not even around here at this point. But so no, not really. I mean, what happens more is, you know, I suppose just like any profession where people work together, you know, is I'm still in touch with lots of attorneys here in town who were deputy prosecutors. You know, when I was a deputy prosecutor, back when we all had hair and were younger, and so clearly, you know, that group. I mean, you develop a real bond, you know, working in our office. There's no question.
What's it like going from working for the man to being the man? What's the difference? Do you have more sympathy? Do you have more empathy? Do you have more understanding of what your $45,000 a year sex crimes prosecutor has to deal with?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, I think that's fair. And you know, one of the things that you know, we've tried to do from day one is to make sure, you know, in an office of 400 people that no one thinks that they're being neglected. You know, our child support division, which I, you know, I'm not criticizing any of my predecessors. I think they were always treated like the bastard stepchild, if I can say that on your podcast.
You can. You know,
over the years. And they do
but that's
very,
real
they,
money they, for real people.
They
who
do
are
very, very
that.
Important. I mean, we have 50,000 open child support files. We collect $100 million a year in child support for custodial parents. It's significant work. And so, you know, I think one thing, you know, when you're a deputy, you know, you're in your little, you know, silo. You know, in my case, I was doing white collar crime and, you know, some street crime cases. But, you know, I guess as the prosecutor, as I should, I've got the big picture, you know, of our office and what makes it work. I mean, it's you know, significant as we have this conversation. This is Administrative Professionals Week right now, and you know, so I think in one way, yeah, that it, you know, we I'm conscious of the fact that when we're trying to get our employees paid appropriately, that we're not only talking about, you know, our attorneys right out of law school, it's people are coming in as our paralegals, you know, our victim advocates, and the work they do is just as significant as everyone else in the office.
Forgive the phrasing, but is it a crime how little prosecutors are paid?
Absolutely. We lost last year 62 attorneys in the year. 32. I'm sorry, 32 last year. And the vast majority of the attorneys we've lost in the last couple of years have not gone to law firms or private practice. They've gone to other prosecutors' offices where
really?
They have smaller offices, so that's smaller budgets, and they can afford to pay $15,000-$20,000 more. So, I respect Fatty Kodora, the city county controller right now, and Fatty has done a great job, but he probably cringes every time he gets my email because you know we're just working very hard. And then I will say this: we've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years. But I mean, you know, the idea that you know young people are coming out of law school, you know, with student debt, and then doing very, very important work for the public and getting paid, you know, what our attorneys are paid is exceedingly unfortunate.
What's the average? A rough idea what the average would be.
We have. Our brand new attorneys right out of law school start at $48,000. Our major felony prosecutors, non-supervisor major felony prosecutors are all probably making 60 to high 60s. You know, these are people who are prosecuting murder cases and the most serious offenses. We had an attorney who retired at the during my first term, he had been there for 38 years as a deputy prosecutor. At that point, the highest paid deputy in the office, and he was making $92,000.
And he could have tripled, quadrupled that on the outside if he had chosen to go that route, perhaps?
Yep.
The law profession gets a beating. I'm not here to defend it necessarily.
Of us deserved.
Well, Shakespeare didn't do it any good. Henry V, I believe, isn't that right? Yeah. Henry V, first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
Right. I wouldn't go that far. But.
What is it about the legal profession, if you could wave a magic wand, that you would change, reform, make better? Or is it just like, this is the hazard of what we do for a living?
Oh, I think, you know, most people would say that if we could have a more civil approach to the practice, and I'm not obviously describing all attorneys, but and I think it is by definition an adversarial process. If you are a trial attorney,
sure,
you know, and that's been my life. You know,
sure,
I've never been tax attorney or probate attorney, or, you know, which is the different areas of practice. But those involved in a litigation, or whether it's on the civil side or criminal, I think we've just lost some level of civility and
marrying society as a whole.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
In other words, people say that civility in society as a whole has diminished.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's exactly the same, but you know, in the practice, we need to be able to be objective, you know, about our cause, you know, mm-hmm. whether that's prosecuting a case or whether you're, you know, filing a civil case. We need to be objective about it and realize that the person on the other side is not your enemy, you know, mm-hmm. and clearly there's so many examples of those who, you know, we have the ability to try a case against each other and then, you know, at the end of the day, drink a beer and be friends. You know, Jimmy Voiles is the best example that comes to mind. And I just feel that, you know, and it's not just me. I know many have that same feeling that it's sort of win at any cost. And so if I could fix one thing, it would just what we all could be thoroughly professional and civil in approaching our jobs.
What's it like as a trial attorney at the prosecutor's office to win, to turn around and look at the family of a victim and know that you've helped bring a sense of closure or justice? And then what's it like to turn around and look them in the eye after you lose?
Yeah. I guarantee you that every single major felony deputy prosecutor would tell you that, you know, if you've won a horrible sex crimes case or a homicide, you know, just to get that hug that you get from the victim or the victim's family, you know, it sounds corny, but you know, that's what makes it worthwhile. And you know, for me, it's interesting too that you know, it's sort of an unspoken understanding in the office that's you know, why we do this work, but we don't go around wearing our sleeve. You know, no one goes around talking to each other within the office about that. But, you know, in this context, I can describe it for you. I guarantee you that's what every single deputy prosecutor would say. You know, and then, you know, sometimes, you know, first of all, if you're going to be a trial attorney, you're going to lose cases. That's a given. You know, there are going to come circumstances where you lose a case.
How do you get over it? I just can't understand how you could get over it.
And you know, it is difficult. And you know, there are occasions when you know that the victim, you know, might have hard feelings, but I think for the most part, they see how hard we work. They see how much we put into it, and you know they appreciate, you know, even though they're horribly disappointed, they appreciate that, you know, we've made the effort. But oh yeah, I tried, and when I was a deputy prosecutor, I tried a 9-week securities fraud trial. The jury was out 4 days, and eventually came back with not guilty after 4 days. Oh yeah. I wanted to slip my wrist at that point.
When was the last time you were in the elevator, on the treadmill, driving a car, and a case you lost just flashed in your mind, and you're like, man, I should have won that, or God, I can't believe I lost that? You don't have to say the case, obviously, but is that something that happens?
Oh, yeah, you think about it. Yeah, yeah, no question.
A friend of mine was murdered in 1997, I believe. His name's Jeff Fosnott. Best basketball player he ever would have met. He was killed at a bar in John Wayne's. named John Wayne's in Southport. And it's the only time I was ever in the courtroom for something like that. And actually his parents let me live in their basement for 2 months before I went in the military, December, January, 1986, 1987. And he's one of my very best friends, and it's a loss we all still feel to this day. His birthday was just in early April. But to see the look on their faces that the man who killed their son was just going to walk away a free man, it was devastating. And I'm related to it through friendship. Mm-hmm. But if that was my job, is to put that man in jail, and I didn't do it, it just makes me respect the profession of prosecuting, if that's the right term, even more. Because you are so invested. The famous, and wouldn't ever ask you about the trial, that would be unfair, but the famous or infamous heart-wrenching video of Goldman's sister and father after the OJ verdict, where you mm-hmm. just watch that family just be devastated. Does that drive you to stay in the game, or does sometimes it just makes it too painful to be in the game? And I use game colloquially, mm-hmm. of course.
Right. No, I think, you know, if you as you go into this, you have to go in with the realization that that could be a result. You know, if you're going to be a trial attorney, you have to understand that you're going to occasionally lose a case, and that all you can do is the best you can do and put everything into it. I mean, one thing that I wish the public understood is the challenges we face, you know, to prosecute cases, you know, with just witnesses recanting on us, you know, witnesses, you know, dodging us. It is a challenge, and I'm incredibly proud of our office and the success we have, given the challenges that we do face every single week. But again, you know, what makes it worthwhile is the successes that you do have. You know, and for me, even though, you know, at this point, I wish I had more time. I tried one case the first term. I tried one case the second term. Handling the case currently, so I don't get to try cases a lot, but I do pretty frequently get feedback, you know, where someone will drop me a note about, you know, how much they appreciate our office did, and naming obviously the various staff members who worked on their case, and so you just keep doing the job week after week, knowing that you will have those successes and dealing with the disappointments. I mean, your comment about your friend, you know, one of the things that we have to do just every single week is meeting with people who have either they've been victimized by crime or being the families of homicide victims, and frequently in homicide cases, where there's a potential consideration of death penalty or life without parole, I meet with the families also, and I every time I am in one of those meetings, the same thing occurs to me, which is I realize myself that I can't begin to comprehend the anger and grief that you must experience from losing a family member or a friend to a violent crime.
It's just, I mean, it's destructive to all of us, and we still think of him and talk about him and text about him and remember him all the time. He was a singularly lively individual, mm-hmm. and it's still awful. We don't ever let it go. And
the other thing that kind of inspires me in this regard is I am always just I don't know if humbled is the right word, but just it's incredible to see how often individuals in that situation ultimately handle their loss with dignity and grace. And you know, Joe and Spencer Moore, who are retired police officers who lost their son David Moore, are the perfect example of that. And you know, clearly they have the ability to summon, you know, something, an energy and a faith to move past it. And it's something that I've seen over and over and over.
We have just a few minutes before we start the five questions. So if we can get through two or three things quickly, I wanted to ask you about, and you may not be able to answer, but I wanted to give you a chance to chat about it. It was a Saturday night, I think, and all of a sudden I heard this loud explosion in my house in Southport. I walked outside and there's insulation all over my front yard. What in the world's going on? It was Richmond Hill. So I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but when you look at the case, and this is just obviously based on my reading from media reports, I have no inside knowledge. You just want to go, kind of ignorant hilljacks decided to do this. Like, what in the world are you thinking? That you think that we're not going to discover what this was all about? Like, this was a no-brainer. Not a no-brainer, but like, it wasn't exactly some sort of deep-thinking Einsteinian conspiracy. Now, I know you may not be able to comment that way, but when you get to something like Richmond Hill, do you just, the tragedy is terrible, but do you just shake your head and go, what in the world are you guys thinking?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And, you know, and one of the things I said more than once after that happened, you know, if the public or individuals who are inclined to do that knew the level of sophistication of the arson investigators and ATF, you would never think about doing that, because clearly they understood from the first moment there were clues. I mean, I'll give you one example, is that the microwave had blown from inside out. And so, you know, if it had just been a fire, normal fire explosion, it might have been charred, it might have been dented, but there's no reason it would have blown from inside out. And so, yeah, clearly from day one. On the other hand, you know, I don't want to say I take offense, but I respond when people think that was a lay down case, because that both those trials went to trial were tried, one in South Bend, one in Fort Wayne, where our deputy prosecutors are doing about a 4-week trial with 180 witnesses and over 2,000 pieces of evidence, trying a case out of their hotel room. And so, I mean, the public, again, will never appreciate what an undertaking that was to try those cases.
Agree. I think that these, and public defenders, too, are paid at about
absolutely
half of what they should be paid.
Absolutely, I agree.
At a minimum. You were outspoken this past year about the need for hate crimes legislation. We're not political on this show per se, unless we're laughing and getting along well. But take a minute or two and please tell the audience, the leaders and legends, why you think and thought it was so important.
All right. I mean, what we have in our sentencing statute, which is what we were talking about, is there are provisions in there that are circumstances where, in my mind, the point of having those in there, for example, you're subject to additional punishment if your crime is committed against an individual under the age of 12 or over the age of 65, for example, is that what those represent are policy statements by the legislature on behalf of the community, on behalf of the state. And to me, there couldn't be any better example of that of crimes that are committed against someone because of their sexual orientation, because of their religion. I won't drill down the weeds too much. I mean, I even think that it should be an enhancement, meaning it should be a more serious offense, a level of offense, as opposed to an aggravator. And so, you know, we actually became involved in it 4 years ago. And the more we've been involved, and the more I've talked about it in terms of testifying to the legislature, speaking to community groups, I've just become more convinced that it's something that we should include in our criminal code.
Death penalty, yes or no, for you personally? I know it's part of the statute, and you have to say yes or no, but...
Right. We have filed in 8.5 years, 5 death penalty cases. I feel like as prosecutor, you know, without regard to personal feelings about it, you by definition, because it is the law, have to be in favor of it. The one thing that we do and we take very seriously is we established a process in the office how we evaluate those cases. And the fundamental point is that decision has to be a very deliberative process. And what we want, in particular, the family to understand when they come in and they are angry and grieving is how protracted that process will be. And so in four of those cases, we've resolved four of them by an agreement and a plea to life without parole.
And you have the victim's family sign off on that? Or?
Yeah, and in every situation, there's only one family member in those four cases that still was against that decision. But once they have the ability to reflect and think about that protracted process, what becomes more important to them is the certainty of the result, the resolution, and the ability to one degree or another move past it. And without exception, every time we've resolved it, there are people in the public who beat us up, but they're individuals who read it in the paper on page one. 2 weeks later, it's not part of their life. It's sure. The victims' families who have to live with it. And so, I'm entirely comfortable with the way we've resolved these cases.
Yeah, that's a great point. I guess there's a strain of conservative thought that's becoming more emergent these days against the death penalty, and I associate myself with that, even though people deserve it. I'm against it, even though people deserve it, because of the finality of the death penalty. The very attractiveness of it is what renders it irreversible. Do I think Steve and Judy deserve the death penalty for what he did to that mother and those kids? Absolutely. I mean, Tex Watson and Sharon Tate, the list goes on and on. Smith and Rezanover, right, for what they did to Jack Orberg. Absolutely. Right. But is it difficult to make that call? Because I'm assuming it's a prosecutor, not a prosecutor's office call, but a Marion County prosecutor, Terry Curry, call to say, yes, we will pursue it. No, we will not.
Yes. I mean, you're right. And what we do in our process is we have a committee and we obviously talk about it and get input. And ultimately, yes, it's my decision. And I hope it's obvious that that is not an easy decision.
Absolutely. You're listening to Leaders and Legends, presented by Veteran Strategies and sponsored by the Girl Scouts of Central Indiana and our friend Aaron Shaler, who's a mortgage broker for Grandview Lending. Our guest today is Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, currently serving his third term, recently reelected in 2018. We've moved now to the five questions portion of the podcast extravaganza. Are you ready?
No one warned me about this. Okay.
We have a lot of mutual friends, sir. Someone should have told you.
They should have.
First question. What was your very first job?
Paying job?
Yes, sir.
Mowing grass at Triton Schools.
Triton Central Schools in the Hancock County?
No, Triton in Shelby County.
Shelby County.
Yes. My dad was superintendent. I knew someone. That's how I got the job.
That's funny.
First paying job.
I forgot my second question. Now I'm laughing. What was your first concert?
It was at Clues. It was... The Love and Spoonful and Association.
That's 68,
69? I was a senior in high school and took the study that I abandoned.
Let's go to Clues Hall, honey, where I'm going to attend school and abandon you in a year. What if you could recommend any book to
and the
someone.
Association were the headliners, by the way.
Over Love and Spoonful?
Yeah, if you can imagine that. I can't in hindsight, but...
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. If you could recommend any book to someone to read, which book would you recommend? Because it's well-written, because of its impact.
You don't want me to say this.
Sure.
Audacity of Hope.
No, we're a friendly show. Yeah. We're happy people here on Leaders and Legends. Why? Because of his message? We're obviously talking about a book by former President Barack Obama.
Yeah. Just it to me, it indicated a different direction, you know, in the way we were going to approach. And I think to a certain extent, that's what happened. Not entirely. And, you know,
so you remain a fan?
I am a fan.
Big fan?
Most definitely.
Did you endorse him over Hillary Clinton? I guess in eight you weren't in office.
No, yet, I wasn't in office.
Yeah. But you were part of it. Because there was a little bit of a divide in the state among Democrats.
I'm not sure anyone seeks my endorsement for president. You know, we got 20 candidates yet, and I haven't gotten a call from one of them.
Mayor Pete, I got Terry Curry's number.
I actually ran the Mayor Pete in 2010. That was when he ran for treasurer.
Oh, that's right.
And that's when I met him. And when I, at the time, you know, obviously, without regard to people's politics, I had the same reaction. I was like, God, this guy's bright and just real unassuming, you know. Just
think about that before we get to the last two questions. We'll say this very, very quickly. 2010, he runs for treasurer against Richard Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
Great Republican year. Murdoch wins by 15, 20 points over Pete Buttigieg. 2012, Murdoch is 15 minutes away from being a United States senator, to quote Mike McDaniel. Now, Murdoch's out of politics. Pete becomes Mayor Pete. He's running for president, riding one of the most positive media waves we've probably seen since Barack Obama in 2008.
That's fair.
That's an interesting... Anyone who thinks there are permanent trends in politics or permanent popularity among politicians is ignorant of history, A, and is whistling past the graveyard, B. Fourth question, if you could witness any event in history, which would you choose? Be there as it happens.
I don't know, just randomly off the top of my head, Gettysburg Address.
Which was widely panned at the time. You Lincoln aficionado, are you?
No, not necessarily. But my wife and I are both just complete nerds about historical stuff, and you know, so go to Boston and you know, walk the Patriot Trail and read every single word of the plaques. You know, just all of that would have been.
You'll love our fascinating
to me to witness, to be witness to.
You'll love our podcast coming up with Peter Carmichael, who is a graduate of Pike, went to IPUI, got his PhD from Penn State, but is currently the head of the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College. And it was a fascinating discussion. I think it's a four-hour podcast. I just wouldn't stop. And a good friend of mine, so I couldn't stop asking him questions. Last question. If you could have dinner with anyone currently living, whom would you choose?
Barack Obama. And Michelle.
There's a couple. They're engaging. Yeah. And anyone who says there isn't has got a bias I can't understand. I mean, I didn't vote for him, but it's clear that he's a fun, engaging, delightful personality and, you know, wins hands down the person you want to have the beer with.
Yeah, no, a trait that I admire in anyone is self-assuming, self-deprecating sense of humor. And that's kind of like one of the reasons why, you know, Pete Buttigieg is, you know, I like Mayor Pete, but I just love the way Barack Obama and Michelle conducted themselves and continue to do so.
It's funny if you, for a different president, for a different reason, if you look at some of the White House correspondent dinners where George W. Bush gets up there and makes fun of himself mercilessly.
I love that.
He seemed to have fun with the fact that no one thought he was articulate and did various other things. It's very kind of you to come on. I know you're very, very busy.
That was fun.
We are grateful for your service as Marion County Prosecutor. You've conducted yourself with class and professionalism. You have a terrific staff of very dedicated professionals whose contribution to our society every single day is severely underrated. And we appreciate it that you would come on. Thank you, Prosecutor Curry.
I appreciate that, and thank you for recognizing the 400 women and men who work hard every day in our office.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.